interview with Ralph Turlington, T-U-R-L-I-N-G-T-O-N, Commissioner of Education in Florida and former legislator, May 18, 1974.
My name is Ralph Turlington. I was born in Gainesville, Florida, October the 5th, 1920. The son of a University of Florida professor who was a native of North Carolina, and graduate of North Carolina State and Cornell. All the Turlingtons, I think, originated in North Carolina. I'm sure the people listening to this tape will be enthralled with this information.
What prompted you to run for the state legislature back in 1950?
Well, really, ever since I was a kid, and this would probably go back to really grammar school, I'd always been involved in political activity. I can remember the presidential election of 28 when the question of whether Al Smith or Herbert Hoover should be elected came in. I believe I was about 7 or 8 at the time, almost 8. And I guess I just always have followed politics. And we had a teacher, I think in the 6th grade, we had a class club there that we'd hold elections about every month. And I don't know, it kind of got us interested. In the 5th grade, we had a teacher there that asked for a debate. And this was in the 30s. Republicans and Democrats, you know, this was the way they were approaching it. And they asked who all were Democrats, and everybody held up their hand. And they asked who were Republicans. I held up my hand under the theory that whoever got to debate, you know, would have to be selected from one group or the other. And I knew I could be selected. So I guess you could say I just have always enjoyed history and politics. In our high school, I went to the P.K. Young Laboratory School, which is actually the demonstration school of the University of Florida. I think the teachers and instructors there were all politically oriented. The friends that I developed, one being Bill Norman, we were just very interested in politics. I've watched every political race there ever was. When we had 13 candidates for governor one year, I could name all 13 and tell when they came in. I had a political sign from each. So I've just been a long-standing interest in politics. So when I went to teach at the University of Florida, I actually wanted to run for a local office like city commission or something like that. The rules were against it. You couldn't be on the faculty and run. I didn't have a doctor's degree, only a master's degree, and I had to make a decision, and I determined that I would leave teaching and go into business, and I also wanted that I could run for a political office. An incumbent didn't run for the legislature, and I thought that was a good opportunity, and so I ran. And I was, Gainesville was hometown and so forth, so being successful there was probably easier for me than it would be for somebody, you know, that hadn't had long-time family connections.
Someone told us a story of about you arguing a bill in the old Senate, I think it was, and the chairman saying something about he found the case very persuasive, and just you and he were in there, and he convened the meeting and had a bunch of proxies.
No.
What was that story?
That's really not my story. That's Cliff Harrell, who later became senator from Dade County, and at the time was a House member. In those days, the Florida legislature was probably, from a population standpoint, the worst apportioned legislature in the country.
This is when, in the
50s? I guess this would have been about 1950, 55 maybe. At that time, we had proxy voting in the Senate. When I first came to the House in 1951, we had proxy voting in the House. And that just simply meant that if here was a bill coming up in committee and you gave me your proxy, I could vote your vote as if you were present.
Only in committee?
only in committee. A proxy vote, of course, never occurred on the floor. Our Constitution requires a roll call vote on final passage of every bill.
Was that unique to this state?
I don't know that it is. I expect a number of others have it. But that's why, you, for example, in Congress, you won't find a whole lot of roll calls. I know one year I compared, and a congressman had voted about maybe 70, 80, 90 times, something like that. I'd voted over 2,000. Well, that sounds more impressive than it really is. Just on final passage of everything, why, you call the roll. A lot of those votes are unanimous votes, whereas in Congress, you know, they'd only call the roll as an exceptional matter, and they'd pass the others on consent, because there's nothing in the federal Constitution that says you have to have a roll call on the final passage of a bill. It happens to be in our Constitution. Senator Harrell, it's really a very interesting story, and both principals are still alive. One later became the acting governor of Florida, governor of Florida, Senator Charlie Johns, who's something of an institution in Florida. This was in the days of the apportionment where no county could have more than one senator, and the number of senators could not be in excess of 38. And you can figure out what that does to apportionment. And in the House, we had no county could have more than three, and each county will have one. And the first, well, really, we laid it out. The first five will have three, the next 18 shall have two, and everybody else shall have one. That was the way it was. So as badly skewed as our population is, this really meant that you could elect a majority of either house by, from counties having about 14% of the population. Now, that the proxy voting, was just part of our procedures, and it was eliminated in the House in 1955 by Ted David, who became Speaker, and he proxy voting was justified on the basis of having conflicting committee attendance times, and Ted set it up into groups so that if you couldn't be on a committee, that if it might set it up into five groups, and group five could not meet when committees in group five would all meet at the same time, and you couldn't be on two committees that were group five committees. Therefore, you'd have no committee conflicts, unless you had to be somewhere else presenting a bill or something like that before another committee. But the proxy voting was justified on this attendance type of thing. And Cliff had a bill that he'd worked to get through the House, and he came over and he saw Senator Johns, who was chairman of the committee. Now, he'd had enough trouble getting his bill taken up. You know, he asked him if he'd notice it and if he would take it up. Finally, he worried Senator Johns to where Senator Johns said that they would take it up, and he gave him the date. Then Cliff came by ahead of time, about, oh, maybe 45 minutes to an hour ahead of time, and he called on Senator Johns, and Senator Johns said, "Tell me about the bill." And Cliff sat down and described the bill and went over it in great detail. Then Senator Johns looked at his watch and said, "It's time to go to the meeting." And they went to the meeting, and the only persons there were the secretary for the committee, Senator Johns, and Representative Harrell. Then Senator Johns sat up and called the meeting to order, and then he indicated that they were there to take up Bill So-and-So, which was the very bill that Cliff had been talking to him about. And before that, he'd called, Senator Johns declared by proxy that the quorum was present. And then he said, "Now, Representative Harrell, would you please explain your bill?" But Cliff had been in his office and explained the blooming bill, and he said, "You mean what?" He said, "Yes, explain the bill." And Cliff went through, said, "You mean the whole thing?" And said, "Well, yes." Said, "You know, the committee needs to know about it." And so Cliff went through the whole thing all over again, explaining the bill. And then senator said that it's moved that the bill be reported favorably. There's Does anyone else want to speak? Wasn't anybody else there to speak, of course? And move the bill be reported favorably. He made that motion and said the secretary will call the roll. But well, Senator Beal and John Sweet Children said no by proxy. And, you know, Senator Davis, no by proxy. Senator Shands, no by proxy. And he went down and called the whole roll. No by, no, 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 all by proxy. And then they said, Mr. Chairman. And Senator John said, you know, that's a damn good bill. Mark me yes. And with that, he got up and that adjourned the meeting. That's just, other than my having told the story, that's really what it is. If you want, Senator Harrell is still, he later became a senator from Dade County. He's still here. He'll be here and usually stays at the Hilton Hotel. And he can tell you if you want to get it direct from him about how it works.
If you wanted to open a section in a book about the pork chop days, would that kind of a story be symbolic of, or is that an overstatement?
Well, when you say symbolic, I guess it isn't a bad story to open with any for any kind of meeting. It did show Charlie had a sense of humor, although I don't think Cliff appreciated it. But that I think that would have some symbolism to it. Yes. And
well, when you think about the two periods, because you served in both. How would you look at the two?
Well,
how would you describe the two? Did you serve in any kind of a leadership role in the first period?
Well, I was always, after the first year, I was always chairman of the committee that dealt with retirement, which is actually pretty, when you get down to it, it's got a lot of clout to it. People never really recognize that to begin with, but you can spend more money or do more things in passing retirement legislation. And most people are aware of. So that was sort of my committee, and I became a specialist in that committee. And till this day, I'm still, I think, quite influential in terms of retirement legislation. So I had that element of a leadership role. I was always on the Appropriations Committee. My first session, my county had two members, and I was the freshman, and Gene Whitlock, who was he knew how to operate, was the fellow that had the Appropriations Committee assignment and so forth, and I had mostly, you know, just the chicken assignment. Second session, I was the senior member, and I had supported Ferris Bryant, who later became governor, for speaker. I guess you could say that since 1953, I've done reasonably well because I don't think there's ever been a person that's become speaker that I at least was not supportive of. Well, that doesn't mean that I was close enough in those instances to be, you know, really at the top, but a lot of those. But I actually broke with the Little County Group on reapportionment. I stayed with the Little County Group, and the Little County Group was predominantly the controlling influence until about 55 or so in there, when reapportionment constitutionally came up, and I just quit attending the so-called Little County meetings. The Little Counties that group was presumably designed to protect the financial and legislative interest of small counties and the division of racetrack funds and road funds and things of this sort. They were highly successful, and well, they might be. If you really want to know, we had money that was divided, and this happened, and this was not changed until I became speaker. But it really didn't change because I became speaker, but it changed because the constituency that elected the legislature changed. I would not be critical of the so-called pork chop era people, you know, as not being persons who sought to represent the interest of their district as they saw it, and I think that they they represented overall state interest with reasonable fairness, subject to the caveat that, after all, they were elected from relatively small counties. You see, there's a limit if you are sitting there, and here's the way the gasoline money was distributed. The first 4 cents went to the Department of Transportation for primary roads, and primary roads were defined by saying we'd have ten or 11,000 miles, and the department designated which of these roads were primary. But that was, whenever that designation was made, why, I'm sure that that was done with the concurrence of the rural interest. So the primary roads were to be paid for out of those first 4 cents. The next 3 cents, we had a 7 cent tax, were secondary in character, two of which were constitutionally earmarked, and one of which was statutorily earmarked in the same way. All right, now let's assume that a penny of gasoline tax raised $30 million. All right, that means you're distributing $90 million, and we would distribute it with on three factors: population, area, and contribution to the state road system as of 1931. Okay, so if your county had 1% of the area, and it had 1% of the road mileage as of 1931, and 0.1% of the population, you would get 0.7% of the secondary road funds. If your county had, as Dade County did, some 17% of the population, some 1.5% of the area, and some, I would judge maybe 0.2% of the road contribution in 1931, because it wasn't really such a big county at that point. You see, if it failed to recognize any growth since 1931, that's a factor. And area, of course, was a big factor. You see, the population really weighted only 1/3 of the distribution. Well, obviously, this would generate a very considerable number of dollars, you see, to rural areas in comparison with urban areas, because population only counted for 1/3 of the weight. And another 1/3 really was predicated on what you had in 1931. And if you look at the enormous growth in some of the areas and the failure to grow in a number of other areas, you can see that this badly misapplied the funds from a current need basis. Well, attempts to change those formulas were just utterly hopeless. And you could not blame a person representing a county that was had not grown very much since 1931 and was relatively low in population from voting against a reallocation of those funds. That's just plain, you know. You can call
similar formulas in addition to roads applying to what other services? Health?
Well, roads, I think, is one of the greatest places. Racetrack funds is another that historically comes to attention. Now, racetrack funds, that was a constitutional amendment was needed, and Governor Carleton was opposed to it. And they needed to get some extra votes or something, you know, to allow sin to have its way by allowing legalized gambling of this pari-mutuel sort in the state. At least that's the story. And the little counties, they got the votes from the little counties by agreeing that racetrack funds would be distributed in equal dollar amounts by county. So that a county, if you were going to distribute $6,700,000 a year each, and you have 67 counties, each county would get $100,000. Okay. By the year 1967 or so, the distribution of racetrack funds was somewhere in the vicinity of $28-29 million. And each county would get approximately 1/67 of that. Not approximately, but exactly 1/67. A portion, that is, the portion that was distributed to counties would be in equal shares.
Now, the basic apportionment change occurred in 66.
The basic apportionment change, now we had the 1965 House was, no, I would really say we had in the House of Representatives a basic change. I think in 63. And that was an apportionment plan that I helped to put over. And interestingly enough, a person that was very instrumental, there were two people that I would say were very instrumental in preserving the and supportive of the position that I took, was Bill Chappell, who's now congressman. And Bill was speaker, or had been speaker, and he was in 61, and he was a strong, you had to have a strong allegiance to the little county group in order to be elected speaker. And I never had that close an affinity. In other words, I was not supportive of the group's reapportionment posture in most situations. And I never made the attempt to run for speaker because I didn't figure that, well, a number of reasons, but I didn't figure I could make it with that form of apportionment that was there at the time. Chappell was elected in 61 speaker, and Mallory Horn, now president of the Senate, was elected speaker of the House in 63. I don't recall when the Baker versus Carr decision was rendered, but I guess it was somewhere
62, I believe.
In about 62, and there we were faced with Baker versus Carr and trying to figure out what to do. It's almost hilarious to look back today, from today, on those years, and see what people thought, you know, might be suitable apportionment. The court was very nebulous in the guidelines that it laid down. It really didn't lay down any guidelines. And for legislators to be criticized for not passing legislation that would meet court requirements, the court requirements were changing so fast that nobody would know what they were. And the argument as to whether this applied to one house or to both houses and this sort of thing came into picture. And interestingly enough, the governor always sided with the Senate, with the idea that the House should represent population and that the Senate should represent area. I took the posture that every county, that it was, should be the other way around, that if each county was to have representation in a legislature, that the House of Representatives was the logical place to give consideration for political units, and that the Senate would be the more logical place to give consideration to population, since the Senate didn't have representation for each county anyway. And if you adopt the premise that every county has to have somebody, and the senators were all insisting that that should be done, then the senators would insist that the House was the one that was supposed to be predominantly in apportioned on a population basis. But when you give every county out of 67 one seat, and 34 of 67 counties have about 6 or 7% of your population, in order to get any significant percentage of people to elect a majority of the House, you've got to go to rather enormous numbers. That didn't seem to bother Governor Bryant, or it didn't seem to bother the Senate, but it did trouble Bill Chappell and myself and Mallory. And they passed, I thought, some pretty awful legislation, you know, for apportionment. And the first one was really adding seats in the House. I think Bill and I got that thing knocked down to 125 members or something in that range, which, remember, we'd been operating with 95, and they were trying to push us up to numbers substantially greater than that. They got that passed, and the court, or somebody, I believe, ruled that, obviously a court, ruled that that was not sufficient population weight. and that we would have to try again. The crazy adjustment over in the Senate was to give, the Senate actually went down in the number of people required to elect a majority. That was the deal that the governor worked out with them. It was a disgrace, in my judgment. What they did was no county could still have more than one senator. And there were a few counties like Sarasota and Seminole that didn't have their own senator, and so they were able to add on. I think they moved the number of senators up to, I don't know, from 38 to maybe 40 or 44 or something of that sort. And they really just added on to some of these counties that are really rather modest in size but didn't have their own senator. It was a question of, if you want to tell us what pork chopism was mostly about, was that you would not, under reapportionment legislation, do anything that was really adverse to a member of the group. And that they sat there with more courtesy for years, and it was, and admittedly under our Constitution, you couldn't have done very much about apportionment anyway, you know.
I'm going to make one quick phone call and go ahead.
Okay.
When did all the changes in our legislative organization, procedures, staffing, salaries, and all that, when did that occur? We understand it started to occur under you when you were Speaker.
Well, I think a lot of that did. Let me go back on this one other point, if you want to bear that in mind. That when the court threw out that first plan, Governor Bryant called us in and told us that we had to add more numbers in the House, and he insisted that we go to 144 members or something that gave a greater percentage of people required to elect a majority of the House. And I didn't like the number. I wanted to keep the number as low as possible. And the governor said that since the court threw out the other, we must make improvement, and there was no way for us to get down to a low figure like I wanted. I wanted a number of around 110, unless we could have a greater number of people electing a majority. And said, well, if we could work out a plan that would accomplish this with a lesser number than the number that he had, would he approve that? And he said yes, that he would, knowing full well that there was no such way to concoct such a plan. At least that's what he thought. Whereupon we said, well, we have such a plan and we accept your agreement. And then what we did, we just took the counties that had two seats and eliminated and stripped them of one of their seats, and that included my own county. You know, you go back home and tell folks, at that point we were able to show where we could, with 110 members, achieve a better population allocation than had been in the plan that the court had turned down. And he had agreed that he would accept that. I know he felt very frustrated to think that that was part of it, but he had agreed to it. And Mallory Horn agreed that he would not run for re-election. You know, there were two seats in Leon. He gave up his own seat. My colleague, O.C. Fagan, was not going to run. You know, we had a lot of that stuff resolved, and so we came in with a House for the 63 session with about 110 members. The court, however, ordered us to add on these additional seats, or some additional seats anyway, from the more populous counties. So in the 63 session, we wound up with 125 people there, but they didn't put anybody out. But I'd satisfied, had we not done that to keep the numbers down, today the legislature of Florida would be, or the House of Representatives would be in the vicinity of about 150 members, not 120. Although I might add that this last time I was one of the proponents of 120 as opposed to 100. I'm not so-called completely wedded to that, but a lot of the people in my area were, so I supported it. Now, as to how the staffing changes.
Well, it seems you got really, in the last 25 years, two distinctive periods in terms of the legislature. It dipped about 1965.
Yeah. Well, the real transition is as apportionment came into the picture, that really, even in 65, you could feel the effects of you know, of the population coming in. Because we had in 65 a number of our little county people, you know, were wiped out. Well, they weren't really. Every county still had a member in 65.
Didn't it change in 66?
Really in 66. I guess I was there, and I was not, at that time, the speaker designate. The speaker designate was George Stone of Pensacola. And these things usually were pledged, you know, by previous members, you know, about who they would support the next time. And George was killed in an automobile accident just as the primaries, the Democratic primaries, were getting underway in 1966. And I started to... Hello? I started to... campaign then for speaker, and was first I had the advantage of not having to go back over a long period of months, particularly when the legislature was in session, and solicit votes. All my campaigning came when the legislature was not in session, and we had a whole bunch of new people coming in. I think there were between 400 and 500 people running for the legislature at that time. It was almost like a statewide campaign with enormous numbers. It was a real chore to get letters out to everybody and so forth. And you get pledges from maybe 2 or 3 people running for the same seat. Or you tried to get pledges. And I was successful in winning that contest. And I guess one of the first things that I did was recognize the financial problems that members have. Our compensation had been $100 a month, and then we did have a per diem of $25 while we were in session. I would say quite honestly that some element of financial compensation is an essential ingredient to have a good legislature. Now, some people may not think that's the case. And you can get some people to render some service, and you'll have some fine, wonderful ideas about that. But if you're going to really be in the policy-making business and give the time necessary to do a good job in a legislature, it's going to take some time away from your business, and you're going to limit the kinds of people that can serve.
One of the first things you did was raise the salaries?
Well, our Constitution prohibited any raise in salary. The salary said $100 per month, and it had been that way since 1953. And we just simply provided an expense allowance. And in effect, what do you say was the expense allowance? The expense allowance was $300. And there was no itemization of what the expenses were. Each month you simply submitted an expense voucher, and then we quit that and just simply said, unless we hear from you, we will presume your expenses are $300. So we paid, during my term as speaker, a $300 a month expense allowance, and then there was a salary of $100. We also, from a staffing standpoint, we'd had some of the delegations would be staffed during the session by boards of county commissioners, or people such as this. We provided a legislative aide for every 3 members. So if you had, for example, 9 members from a county, well, we would pay for 3 aides. Well, now, of course, today in the Florida legislature, every member has his own aide. Our committee staffs, lest you get the impression that we added a lot of personnel, I'd like to say that I have the lowest, when I was speaker, I had the lowest number of employees during the regular session per member of any speaker since 1961. And yet we had these additional aides and some additional committee staff that hadn't been, you know, previously there before. And you say, how'd you do that? Well, because we eliminated a number of other jobs, but particularly were they eliminated in the journal room. You say, what is the journal room? Well, every member gets to send some journals back home. The printer would bring the journal in, and they would take it down to the journal room, and the journal people, room people, would mail the journal to the people who were up on the list. And how long did anybody have to work or whatnot? Well, that was unknown. I found we just simply, and I'd have to say I retained a certified public accountant and told him to go over the whole thing and try to figure out what we were, how we could, show a good management record. And the journal room was the first place we went. We just eliminated the journal room and had the printer mail them. The printer did all that for $1,600, and we eliminated, I think it was, I don't know how many people, but it was a fantastic number, because if you had to have somebody on the payroll, well, they could always put him in the journal room. Whether he showed up, I don't know. I can just say that we saved thousands of dollars and reduced the number of employees by a very significant number by just paying the printer $1,600 to mail the journal. Now, we watched the number of employees that we had. But the employees that we had, we tried, we sought to put them into activities that we were more useful. It's interesting to see the, if you go back and get the data, how many employees sometimes were involved. And really, it was just a question of accommodation, putting somebody on a payroll. And the journal room was the biggest boondoggle in the picture. But we tried to improve the staffing of our committees. If I were going to give a commendation, though, to somebody that I think did start in strongest in terms of staffing, I'd have to say that I think Fred Schultz and Dick Pettigrew were the strongest persons in terms of pushing for staff, legislative staff development. Over on the Senate side, they went pretty strong for staff development.
Did the House essentially provide the leadership in that, and the Senate follow?
I'd like to tell you that, yes, being a House guy, I guess I'd like to tell you that, but truth is, I don't think I can react accurately to that, but for the fact that the Senate really loaded a lot of the legislative appropriation in, and I think that the Senate also had the same idea. I'd like to say that it was developed in the House leadership. Maybe the Senate wanted to be sure that it stayed ahead of the Joneses.
When you think back over that last 8 years, would you have believed in 1966 or 67 that the legislature would look like it does today?
No. I mean, frankly, we're better staffed. We've got a lot more things that we do than we ever did, before. I would never have imagined.
How about the members themselves?
You mean about the types of members and so forth that we have now? I'd say the types of members that we have, and I'm not reflecting on the people that we have today are more sophisticated. I don't say that they're necessarily, from a character-wise standpoint, or better. I think there were fine people serving in both eras. And when we tell the story about...
But you do see them as two different eras.
There's unquestionably two different eras, but that's right. And that... Yeah, I think I was there bridging that kind of a situation. I had really, accepted in effect by the new urban groups and urban voters, and I, instead of being something of a maverick from a so-called North Florida rural area, the North Florida people looked on me as one of their better contacts with which to help mitigate the problems that they foresaw coming. And I guess in a way that I've always been this kind of a catalyst, that I have related, I think, pretty well to persons of a different area or background. I still do that. If I'm working on school legislation, that I can go out and in the panhandle and make a good presentation, and I can go down to Fort Lauderdale and make a good presentation. And I can, I think, get persons that might think that they've got some basic conflicts more reconciled to working together.
They used to have that little county group caucused.
We used to caucus. Yeah.
Were they the equivalent in the House of the pork choppers in the Senate? Are we talking about two different kinds of?
I'd say yes. Except you've got to remember, there's some advantage when people want to talk about a small legislature. You can make it so small that it can be too cozy. You know, and that was an argument that I have made. In my judgment, the Senate of Florida today would be a better Senate if it had 50 instead of 40 members. I just don't like the thing when we had 38 senators. If you can get, you know, you get a small group there that can wag that whole thing, you're in trouble. Whereas when you've got a little larger number, a single individual has got a little more difficulty in communicating. And in the House, the numbers are sufficiently great that by the time you've finished communicating, the first ones you spoke to don't quite remember what it was that you had just said. That there's always in the House a good shot on a fresh approach and a fresh argument. You can line up and get things, that's what I mean by cozy. You can get a very cozy arrangement far more readily in a small body than you can in a larger body. The problem with the larger body is the unwieldiness and the realization when it gets too large, a fellow that's really wants to be significant in life, feeling that he's not a significant enough part in the decision-making process to attract and hold his attention and commitment. I mean, you've got those two things to balance off. And I personally would favor a one-house legislature with about 100 members. I think that would cut the mustard better and answer more responsibly to the public as to what you're actually doing than our present arrangement. But I'm not going to use up my time and credits working very hard for that because it's no way in the world to get there. The public won't accept that. We're conditioned in this country to a bicameral situation. We think that must have been ordained by the Lord, or at least some of the angels anyway, even though I don't think
it's our impression that there have been more significant changes in the legislature in this state than almost any other southern state in that 8 years. Is that your impression too?
Our impression what now? That this,
that there have been more significant changes in the way the legislature operates, its procedures, the quality of the bills and so on that passed, the policy making than other state legislatures.
I think this would probably be a reasonable assumption.
Well, why is that?
Well, I think one, we have you have to recognize on a population standpoint the enormity of change that we had. If you were electing a majority of the Senate and a majority of the House from counties having less than 14% of the people, and you went to a one-person, one-vote, I guess you caught that ERA language in there, one person, one vote principle, you have made a very significant change, you know, just in the makeup, geographically if nothing else. Now, when I became Speaker, it was the greatest turnover of people you ever had. We had out of 117 people that showed up there in that November, and then later that got thrown out and we had to go to 119 and hold a whole nother re-election. We had close to 75 to 80 new members. And I was sitting there without any, you know, the talent pool was rather limited, especially the experience talent pool. And Lord, it was, and we had a Republican governor. Looked like the world was, was going to wipe out all the Democrats. Our guys were so darn timid. And the Republicans that were newly arrived, they were all suspicious. It was, frankly, to finally, after 17 years in the legislature to arrive, and then to have that fall in on you when you once became speaker, you know, it was a rather traumatic experience. There was just simply an enormous change from an experience standpoint. We needed some of the experience that we had before. You had to start over and educate persons to what really these issues were. And if I tried to move legislation too fast, people felt there was something real sneaky going on, you know. That's particularly from the Republican end. And it was extremely difficult to operate. And then we had a governor who, I'd have to say for him, that he had the capability of attracting more attention, and he was a very colorful person. And for a while, people believed that he really consistently understood what he was doing. I'm talking about Claude Kirk. I'd have to say Claude Kirk can be one of the most delightful personalities you'd ever meet. But he was brand new, and he had made commitments in his campaign that were utterly impossible to carry out. And there I was, and the teachers, you know, the teacher walkout and all that other stuff came during this era. It was a very interesting time, I might add.
What was the role of the capital press, the fact that it is an aggressive press?
We seem to have, and I think one reason we probably have it is because of the way our cities are laid out. Well, I think our press here is more aggressive and involved than the press of about any other state, and certainly more so than the Washington press.
Did this provide an impetus for change at the time? An impetus for reform when the change came. That's my real question. You had the change in the makeup of the legislature. The
press was relatively impotent under the old arrangement, except that they were always in there causing a lot of attention. Let's take the Tampa Tribune. I would say